Okay, good morning. It's nice to be back here. I hope no one minds that I'm speaking about a earlier Bereshit topic. This was supposed to be spoken about the Sunday of Hurricane Sandy. And I had to reschedule because we didn't have power and I couldn't leave my husband alone with four kids in the dark without heat. So we're back. So today's topic is Abraham's top 10. And we're going to take a look at the 10 tests of Abraham. We're all familiar with the idea that Abraham was tested 10 times. What I want to do this morning is analyze where this idea comes from. That's number one. Two, which events in Abraham's life constitute these tests, make up these 10, right? In other words, what are his top 10? And three, what lessons can be gained from analyzing Abraham's life within this perspective, viewing his life within this construct of 10 and 10 tests? And D, and four, why does God test people? It can't be that God is like me in my classroom as a teacher. I give tests because I have no clue if my students are understanding what I'm teaching them, if they've processed it, if they can recall anything that I taught them. So I give them tests to know what's lying. It obviously can't be that God is testing Abraham to know the outcome if God is omniscient and he knows the outcome. So that would be our last question at the end, is why does test people? In general, why test Abraham? I'll keep referring back to our number, what we're up to. So we'll start with our first question is, where does this idea come from? Where does the idea of 10 tests, where is it found? So first answer is, it's not found in the Pesukim. Nowhere in the Torah, in Parshas Lech Lecha, Vayera, Chayitzar, does it talk about this idea of 10 tests. It's found in the Mishnah Perkei Avos. This is source one. Perkei Avot, Parakei, Mishnah Gimel. Asara nisyonot nitnaseh Avraham Avinu, Alav HaShalom, Va'amad kulam lehodia kamach mibatol sh'al Avraham Avinu alav ha'shalom. 10 times Abraham was tested. Our forefather Abraham was tested, and he withstood them all. Va'amad kulam, he passed them all. Lehodia, to show us, and there's two ways to read the ending of this Mishnah. Either, according to Rashi, is to show us how much Abraham loved God. Kamach mibatol sh'al Avraham Avinu, how much Abraham loved God. Or, like Kehati explains, how much God loved Abraham. How much God loved him, and therefore he tested him as a way of showing his affection towards Abraham. So either way, how Abraham loves God, or how God loves Abraham. We'll come back to this idea at the end, you know, about Abraham loving God, or God loving Abraham at the very end, about why God tests. But first we have to understand the context of this Mishnah. This Mishnah is found in the fifth parak of Masechet Avot. And the Mishnayot preceding and after are all about significant tens. For example, the 10 ma'amarot, the world was created, 10 sayings that God created the world, the 10 generations from Adam to Noah, the 10 generations from Noah to Abraham, the asara makot, the 10 plagues in Egypt, the 10 times that Bnei Israel tested God in the Midbar, and so on and so forth. So our 10s is just one 10 amongst this other list and sea of 10s in our Mishnah, in our parak. Some of the tens in the parak are found in the text. We know that there are tens in the text. So for example, the 10 times Bnei Israel tested Hashem in the Midbar, we're not told the 10 are, but Moshe in Devarim says, you tested God 10 times. Some of the tens are not explicitly found in the Torah, but are developed by Chazal. This might sound surprising to us, but the 10 makot, it never says in the Torah in Sefer Shmos that there are 10 makot. Hashem said, I'm going to bring many otot and moftim, signs and wonders. But he never says, I'm going to bring 10 specific makot, and here's number one, and here's number two. Oh, it doesn't appear. So which is why some people say maybe there weren't 10. Maybe there were 11 if you count the one beforehand with the tanin and the snake, the sticks turning into a snake. Where does our 10 fall into place? Where about the 10 nisyonot? Is this a 10 where the Torah tells us there are 10? So for example, like the Aseret HaDibrot, it tells us there are 10. Aseret HaDvarim appears that way in Shmos and again in Devarim. What those 10 are, though, it's not so clear, which is why there is a little bit of debate how you divide up the 10 utterances, the Aseret HaDibrot. Where does our 10 of the 10 tests, where does that fit in? Is that a 10 that appears in the Torah, or is that a 10 that appears only from Chazal? And the answer is, it's a 10 from Chazal. Nowhere in Abraham's life does it say Abraham was tested 10 times. There's no count, there's no list, there's no even sum total at the end. Oh! We've got to 10. This is a notion created by Chazal. So we obviously have to figure out then, why do Chazal pick this number 10? Why do they include this within this larger context of 10. Why do Chazal like the number 10 especially? We do have the concept, though, that Abraham is tested in Tanakh in throughout the prakim of his life. But the word nisa, test, only appears once by Abraham's life, and that is Akedat Yitzchak. Great. So this is source 2. We're told by Hiachar Hazvar Me'ila that Elohim nisa at Abraham, right? Here's our Shorash nisa to test, and God tested Abraham. Vayomer Elav, Abraham, Vayomer Hineni. Abraham responds to the call, here I am. Vayomer Kachna et Bincha, Es Yechidcha, Asher Havta, Es Yitzchak. Velech Lecha El Eretz HaMoria, Ve'aleu Sham Le'ola, Alachad Ha'arim Asher Omar Elecha. We'll get this book a little bit later, but God tells Abraham, go and bring your son, your only son, one you love, bring him to the land of Moriah, and bring him there as a sacrifice. So there the word Nisa appears. So the Mishnah, the oral tradition, believes that Abraham was not just tested this one time when he was asked to sacrifice his son. And although the word does not appear elsewhere in Abraham's life, we don't have the word Nisa, conceptually, this idea runs throughout Abraham's life. He's constantly challenged and meets challenges throughout his life. What's interesting is that not everyone even agrees in this context, even where I have the word Nisa, not everyone agrees that this is a test. The Rashbam, a Shas commentary, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, the grandson of Rashi, he reads the word Nisa here as God troubled, but God punished Abraham. Achar Hadvarim, according to the Rashbam, means that this story comes right after the event that came before him, which is the treaty that Abraham made with Avimelech. Rashbam sees this as a cause and effect. It's perhaps a very political Rashbam, where Rashbam thinks that because Abraham made a treaty with a foreign king, Avimelech, and he relinquished rights to Eretz Yisrael, giving up land for peace, Hashem punished him with Akedat Yitzchak. This is the Rashbam in the 1100s saying this. But so even this one event, which is called the Nisa, not all the Mefarshim viewed as in the pure context of just simply God testing Abraham, giving an opportunity perhaps to shine, the Rashbam sees it as a punitive measure in Abraham's life. It's God is, so to speak, giving a little slap for doing something wrong, a misdemeanor in the chapter beforehand. The Mishnah, however, believes that Abraham was tested many times before he was asked to sacrifice his son, and God clearly with each test wants to teach Abraham some sort of concept. And we'll have to get to later on what concept is Abraham being taught through these tests. So we're going to go with the approach, like most Mefarshim, that this is a test. And now we have to figure out what are the 10 tests. So we know he's tested perhaps once. What are the other tests what other events in Abraham's life are included as a test? So the Mishnah does not enumerate them. The Mishnah does not tell us what the 10 are. All the Mishnah tells us is that there are 10. So we have to look to the commentaries and the Mefarshim on the Mishnah to figure out what they view as the 10. And therefore, they're open, you know, they open the Chumash, find whatever they want to find, because it's not spelled out in the text. We're going to look at each of these parshans. We're going to look at 3 different approaches as to what the 10 tests are, and we're going to evaluate each commentary based on what credentials they're using to decide and decipher what a test is. All right, so again, so all the parshans agree we have got 10, but they don't agree what the 10 are. So we're going to start with the Rambam. This is source 3. Asara nisyonot asher nitnaseh Abraham Avinu kulam kituvim. This is the premise he's working with. Rambam believes that all the 10 tests of Abraham, they're all found and they're enumerated in the actual pshat. So for Rambam's list, he's not going to turn to Midrash. He thinks that you have enough to work with just from the actual psukim. No need to turn to Chazal for what the tests are. Okay, so his list is Harishon Hagerut, Vehu Amru Yisalet Lo, Lechacha Me'artzacha Mimoladecha, Abraham becoming a stranger, leaving his homeland, and coming to Eretz Yisrael is the first test. So if you want to follow along on the Mefarshim, you can follow on the Mefarshim page. If you want to open up your source sheet to the chart, I made a chart of all of the 3 Mefarshim we're going to do, so you can see them side by side. So it's very clear how they differ from one another. So if you see, Rambam is beginning on the 3rd row by Lechacha. Lechacha is his first test. All right, the second test is Hara'at, the famine. Asher Masa Be'aretz Kanan Kasher Hishakeh Be'aretz V'kfar Yu'ad Lo Be'ascha Ve'arecha Ve'gelach Shemecha V'zen Yisayon Gadol V'hu Amru Be'reishit Perek Yubeh Pasak Yud V'hi Ra'ah Be'aretz. The second test is Abraham leaves his homeland, goes to Eretz Yisrael, he's given all these promises, and minutes after he gets there, or not minutes, but a few months after he gets there, there's a famine. The land which he's promised can be given as his inheritance is uninhabitable. You can't live there. You can't survive there. So now he has to leave his homeland. So the Rambam thinks that's a very big test. So will he still trust in God, or does he want the land which God gave him, which just seems to be a lemon? He can't live there. Shlishi, the third test. Asuk ha-mitzrim, otobil kichat zara lefaro. The whole dealing with the Egyptians, when they took Sarah, when Paro took Sarah, his wife, and, God had to come and make a whole miracle happen, but Paro kidnapped his wife. The fourth test, hilachamu ba'arba amalachim, the war of the four kings against the five kings, where Avram goes and fights a world war, him and just a few hundred men. The chamishi, the fifth test, lakho hagar kinoash mihozah Sarah, when he marries Hagar, when Sarah can't have children, when they give up hope of having a child with Sarah. So marrying Hagar, that's a little bit of a strange one. The other Mepharshim don't count that to be a test. Shishi, the sixth one, is Brit Milah. Asher tziva bat b'shnot hazikna, when he was told to get Brit Milah when he was at a very old age. Hashvi'i, the seventh test, was Asuk HaMelech Grar, Otol B'chad Sarah Gamkin. Seven, a little bit deja vu, was when Avimelech, the king of Grar, also takes Sarah, kidnaps Sarah. Shmini, the eighth test, is sending away Hagar after he already had children with her. And then the ninth test is sending away Yishmael after he viewed him as a son. And the tenth test, Akedat Yitzhak. So let's make a little bit of observation about the Rambam's list. So again, all the Rambam's tests come from the Pesukim. There's no Midrash here. What's interesting about the Rambam is that he sees two separate tests in terms of sending away Hagar and sending away Yishmael. He divides that in two. None of the other Mepharshim do that. If he has one test, kicking away Hagar and Yishmael as a test for Abraham. The Rambam divides that into two tests. Sending away his wife, he was married to her, he had some sort of attachment to Hagar, and then perhaps even building upon that even more, sending away his child, Yishmael, who he had a relationship with, who he viewed perhaps as his inheritor of his spiritual legacy, but at least his physical legacy. And he counts also as marrying Hagar as a test as well. Okay, now let's look at our next parshan, the Rabbeinu Yonah. Rabbeinu Yonah starts off, Harishon or Kastim, Sheiflu Nimro Likivshana Ish, Vinitzel, Vizet Eno Bifurash Batorah. Rabbeinu Yonah's first test is not found in the Pesukim. I mean, he's not shy about telling you that. This is very important. It's very important to know what is Midrash and what is Pshat, and the commentaries who use Midrash are not trying to pull a fast one over you. They're telling you that they're Midrash. It was funny, I was just talking to one of my students, we had him over for a Hanukkah party, and we were talking about, kindergarten kids or first graders or how quick they are to read. And I said, my kids are not necessarily reading at kindergarten, I don't push it. And they can learn when they're in first grade. I want them to enjoy it and have fun. So my student said, I bet you there's one thing that you push to your students, to your children. I said, what? He's like, you probably make your children know the difference between Midrash and Pshat. I'm like, that's so true. Whenever I read Parsha, and I have this Parsha book that's laminated produced by Haredi publishers, they don't show a picture of the Avot, and there are so many of these Midrashim woven into the stories. And I'm constantly, as I read this book to my kids, I'm constantly like telling them, this is Midrash, this is the Pshat, I do it over and over again. So yes, that's one thing that I really do teach my children at a very young age. A funny story that goes along with this, so Rabbeinu Yonah's first test is the Kivshana Eish. He's telling you it's in the Midrash. There's a famous story that's quoted in by students of Nechama Leibowitz, that she was speaking to a bunch of chayalim at a tekes, at a ceremony in Israel, some completion ceremony. And like you do in Israel, whenever you go on a teal, you bring your Tanakh with you. She told the students to open up a Tanakh. And she said to them, find me the story of the Kivshana Eish. Find me the story of Avraham being thrown into the fiery furnace with Nimrod. And the Chayalim are flipping through their Tanakh. And then they start slowly but surely realizing, oh, it's not here. They close the Tanakh. This one Chayal was getting very agitated. He was getting very upset. He like throws the Tanakh back in her face and says, this is not the Tanakh that I had at Tzichon. This is not the Tanakh that I had when I was a student in elementary school. Clearly, you gave me a fabricated fake version, because in your version it's not here, but when I was a student, it had to be in the Tanakh. And that's obviously the problem with a little bit of our education, that when Midrash is beautiful, it adds incredible flavor and it teaches us incredible lessons. They're homiletic and exegetical tools for learning Tanakh, but they should not be misconstrued of viewing them as appearing in the actual text. They didn't appear in the text. They're not meant to be appearing in the text. They come for another purpose. So Rabbeinu Yonah does count this midrashic story that keeps on Aish, which we know so famously. It's actually interesting. After I gave a shir once, somebody said to me that her husband was a lawyer and went to Guantanamo Bay. And speaking with one of the inmates there, the inmate said to the lawyer, not knowing he was Jewish, saying, Our, you know, we share the same patriarch, Abraham. We share this guy, Abraham. He goes, and he was put into a fiery furnace and he came out alive. So the woman said to me, how is it that Muslims have this tradition as well? So I didn't, like, I don't know, but I don't know if that midrash carried over into other traditions as well, but that one guy in Guantanamo Bay knew about the Kivshan Aish story. So the Kivshan Aish is his first test. Other things that are important for Rabbeinu Yonah in terms of his list of 10, nothing is so particularly crazy. Let's go to his last one. Ha'asiri kivurat Sarah. The last test for Rabbeinu Yonah is burying Sarah. She'amar lo kumitalech ba'aret la'arka u'rachava kilecha etnena. God promised to give Abraham the entire land of Eretz Israel. And what happens when Sarah dies? Lo makom, lo matza makom lekvara ad shekano v'lo herher. He didn't find a place to bury her immediately. He had to buy a place, a burial a spot for her. You know, God promised him the entire land, and he didn't doubt God. He now goes to the end of the quoting, the end of the Mishnah. Again, all these tests show us how much either Avraham is loved or how much God loves Avraham. So Rabbeinu Yonah starts the test one earlier than the Rambam, and he ends the test, again, one later than the Rambam, with burying Sarah by Maharal Pela. Now if we turn to, in yours I quoted Magen Avos L'Rashbats, but he quotes Perkei de Rabbi Eliezer, and this version is the version which Rashi accepts as well. And in this version, you notice, not only do we start back by the Kishan Aish, we start back even one further. We have another midrash that this approach takes. So this one is Harishon, Kishanolad Asru Nimrot Shalosh Asrei Shana, Shalo Ra'ah Shemesh V'Yareach. This is another midrash, not as well known, that when Abraham was born, he was incarcerated for 13 years. He was placed perhaps in an underground jail or pit, and he didn't see the light of day for those 13 years. That was a miracle. He survived being in this terrible prison for 13 years. Something interesting about the Perkei de Eliezer and Rashi version is that they count Sarah being captive by Mitzrayim. If you look at that, that's, which number is that? Number 5, Batukach Isha Beparo. So Sarah being taken captive by Paro is their number 5th test. But they don't count Sarah being taken captive by Avimelech. So the Magen Avos L'Rashbat who quotes this approach, that's his question. Vanit is the last line. Vanit Tmiya. Lama lo nimne l'kichat Sarah bin Avimelech nisayon. Why don't they count Sarah being taken captive by Avimelech? Kimo l'kichat Beparo, just like she was taken captive by Beparo. What, because it happened once to Abraham, no big deal? It's like a thing taken captive on vacations happens often, therefore it's something strange. If it's a test the first time, it should be a test the second time. So this approach is wondering why they're not counting it. And obviously the reason why they're probably not counting it is because they have so many midrashim they're using, they ran out of shot stories that they can use as counting. And everyone's limited to 10. That's their limit. So we have to figure out what stories constitute those 10. Alright, so just to kind of wrap up, the Rambam again only views the stories in the Pshat as the test. Rabbeinu Yonah adds in a test after Akedah Yitzchak, which is very unusual. Nobody else does that. The idea of buying land for Sarah to be buried in after he was promised the land of Israel. And Perkei de Eliezer and Rashi have two midrashim, adding on the one about Avram being in jail for 13 years. The Rambam believes that marrying Hagar was a test, but no other Mepharshim do that. The Rambam splits sending away Hagar Yishmael as two separate tests. Well, none of the other Mepharshim do that. Avos the Rabbi Natan. Okay, so now we look at another approach. Avos the Rabbi Natan is a minor tractate in the Gemara, and it records the following, their version of the 10. Asaran nisyonot ninasa Avraham Avinu, l'fnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, v'chula nimsa shalim. This is number 6. Avraham Avinu was tested 10 times, and again, he was shalim, he passed all the tests. Elu hain shnayim b'lechacha, two with lechacha, bet b'shnei banav, two with his sons, bet b'shnei nashav, two with his wives. Echad im amlachim, one with the war of the 4 kings and 5 kings, ve'achad b'bris ben aptarim, ve'achad b'or kastim, so it also includes the midrash of or kastim, ve'achad b'brit milah, Kol kach lama kadesh yevei Avraham avinu litol sarot, in order to give Abraham an opportunity to collect his reward. What I want to pay attention to is the formulation in which the Rabbi Natan records these 10. The Mishnah doesn't just tell us 1, 2, 3, 4, but the first 6 categories, he puts them in groupings. 2 regarding Lechafa, 2 with his wives, 2 with his sons. What constitutes those? I think actually it's a little bit confusing. What do you guys think are the 2 with Lechafa? How would you guys interpret that? What's the first Lechafa one? Leaving his family. Second Lechafa? The Ra'av? It's possible. You're saying why was that included under Lechafa? Because it's what, in the same paragraph? Well, he wasn't commanded Lechafa to go to Mitzrayim. It's in parts of Lechafa. Oh, so you want to divide that one story into 2. Leaving your family, and then going to a place unknown. Okay, dividing that one story. So either just dividing the first group, second paragraph, as 2 stories, or like you said, maybe including the Ra'av there, but the Shtei Nashav, you know, maybe not, because we have to somehow include 2 tests regarding Abraham's 2 wives later on. So I thought, what's 2 Lechacha? Go back to source number 2. Abraham's 10th test, according to most of Farshim, what's he told? The word Lechacha also appears by Akedat Yitzchak. In fact, those are the only 2 times this phrase appears in Bereishit. Beginning of Parshat Lechacha, leaving his homeland, leaving or casting to go to Eretz Yisrael, and then going to sacrifice his son, also is the tzivui is prefaced with the same 2 words, Lech Lecha. But then we have the Shnei Banav, so what is Shnei Banav? So maybe it's the birth, being told about the birth of Yitzchak, i.e. the Brit Milah. Maybe it's, and again, what's the one about Yishmael? Is it having Yishmael? Is it sending away Yishmael? Avos the Rabbi Nassan is unclear what are these groupings, but what's significant is that he's making these connections. What he's saying is that there's pairs and parallels within Abraham's life. And even before you even turn to Avos the Rabbi Nassan, we see that clearly within the idea that Sarah was taken 2 times, for example, by Melch Mitzrayim and Avi Melech. Again, all the Mepharshim counted as 2 tests, except for the Rashi approach. Bible scholars, Bible critics will look at these psukim and say, oh, here's a great example where you see that the Torah, the redactor of the Bible, condense different stories, different traditions of one story. So the story of Adimelech, the story of Paro, it's one tradition, but 2 different people wrote it down their own way, and the redactor of the Bible just smushed both the different accounts together into the Torah. Professor Kasuto, I'm going to be quoting a lot today. Umberto Casuto was a Tanakh scholar who was born in Italy, and he made Aliyah, and he died in the 1950s. He's quoted heavily by Nechama Leibowitz, and he wrote 2 books. He wrote 1 book on half of Bereishit, then he died, and he wrote 1 book on Shmos. He would have written more, that's all he got up to. And he writes in his commentary to Bereishit that although Bible scholars, and he actually spent a lot of his time fighting and rebuking and, you know, arguing against Bible scholars, critics who try to denounce the Mosaic authorship of the Bible and point to source criticism, he argues and says that the combination and the parallels of Abraham's test clearly show to us that it's not just some haphazard patchwork, you know, conglomerate into the Bereishit, but really it's one author who wants to show us that these stories are interconnected and that their arrangement is purposeful and pedagogic. Abraham meets a challenge once and then meets it again later on in his life. So Sarah being taken by Paro, then Sarah being taken by Avimelech. And again, looking at the pairs found in this Avos Rabbi Natan, he has 2 challenges that involve his son. He has 2 challenges that involve Lechacha. And I think that we have to understand is that Abraham, when we meet Abraham in Tanakh, we meet him when he's the age of 75. We're going to have another 60 years with him as we travel along his life. He's not the same person at 75 as he is at 100. He evolves and he transforms. Well, the way to see someone's transformation is by comparing them in the same similar situation. If I can look at Abraham and how he acts with Paro in Mitzrayim, and I can see how perhaps he acts perhaps a little differently with Avimelech, well, then I see some sort of transformation with Abraham. Likewise, if I see Abraham with Lechacha, leaving his father, and then I see Abraham, what he's asking to buy Kedah Yitzchak, and he's changed and he's evolved, but I have a common ground to discuss it with, then how much more so I see the evolution and transformation of Abraham. He's not a static, stagnant character. He's evolving, and the stories are trying to help us process that evolution. Okay, great. We'll get to that that whole discussion about Abraham and how he acts in Mitzrayim. Although I had to write a paper recently on the Nuzi tablets, which are the ancient Hurrian city of Nuzi. And the way I would want to defend it, I can't really defend it anymore based on it's not historically accurate. But at least we'll give some sort of defense, make you feel a little bit better, hopefully. Okay. So we have these different tests. Now we at least see this idea that there's a pattern within the test, that there's some sort of interrelatedness between the tests that Abraham has. So perhaps we shouldn't just see them as 10 and 10. We should see them as perhaps 5 and 5. We'll get to that soon. In what areas does Abraham need to be educated in? Why do we think God is testing Abraham? Abraham believes in God at a very young age, according to the Midrash, or according to the Pshat. As soon as God comes to him, he's right on board. He's going out throughout the land of Eretz Yisrael, throughout the cities, being korei b'shem Hashem, calling out a monotheism. He's a great guy. He's a perfect role model for Am Yisrael and other religions to follow what it means to believe in God. Why does God torture him? Why does God put him through these crazy ordeals if he's already a pretty great guy to begin with? So if we look at the first time we meet Abraham, and this idea actually I got from a person named Leon Kass, and he wrote a book called In the Beginning of Wisdom. He was on the ethics committee, bioethics committee of from George Bush the second, George W. Bush, and he's a conservative Jew, but he taught a class on Bereshit, and he wrote down his ideas in this book. It's very, very wordy, but his ideas are very, very insightful and very creative. So looking at source number 7, but the first time we meet Abraham, we actually meet Abraham before Parsha Lech Lecha. We meet Abraham at the end of Parshat Noach in a listing and a kind of an entry of one of the toldot, right, these genealogical listings. But Abraham's listing is atypical of a toldah listing. In a typical toldah listing, you tell me the father, how old he was when the son was born, you tell me how many kids he had, and they tell me that the guy dies and how old he is when he dies. That's typical listing of toldah in the Chumash. When you find narrative in the toldah, it's atypical. You find stories about somebody. So look at source number 7. We're told, Vayechi Tarach Shivim Shana Vayolid at Avram. Tarach was 70 years old when he begat Avram. Vayad Nachor, Vayad Haran. That's typical, right? He's 7 years old when he had these three children. When he started having those three children. Ve'ela toldot Tarach. These are the genealogies and the stories of Tarach. Tarach will lead at Avram. At Nachor, Vayad Haran. Haran will lead at Lot. So that's already atypical. Tell me who Haran had. Haran had Lot. So Avram's youngest brother had a son named Lot. Now we're told Pasuk Chavchat, Haran dies, Vayimat Haran apenei Tarach Avi, Be'aretz Mulad Atob, or Kastim. Again, atypical. If he dies, don't include him in the Toldah listing. If someone dies before their father's lifetime. So Haran dies while Tarach is still alive, while they're still living in Or Kastim. Vayikach Avram v'Nachor lahem Nashim, Shem Esha Avram Sarai, V'Shem Esha Nachor Milka, V'Haran Avi Milka, V'Avizka. Okay, now we're told this Avram marries Sarai, and Nachor marries Milka, the daughter of his brother. Vatihi Sarai Akara in Lavlan. Unusual. Now I'm being told, Sarai, Avram's wife, is an Akara. She's barren. She has no children. Pasuk Lamed Aleph, Vayikach Tarach at Avram beno, Ve'at Lo ben Haran beno, Ve'at Sarai Kalaso Eshet Avram beno, Ve'yitzu Itam Eor Kastim, Melechat Arza Kanan, Ve'yavo Ad Haran Ve'yishru Sham. Now we're being told about a family trip. Tarach takes Avram, Lot, Sarai, and they leave from Or Kastim traveling towards Eretz Canaan, but they don't make it to Eretz Canaan. They stop and they settle in Haran. If you look at the atypical information we're given here about Avram, we're really being told two things that are unusual. One is that his wife is barren, he has no kids. And two is he doesn't have a home. He's traveling. They're from Or Kastim. They want to go somewhere else, but now they're living in Haran. When we meet Abraham in the beginning of Parashat Lech Lecha, and God promises Abraham, Zerah, you're going to have children, and I'm going to give you Aretz, a land to call your own. These are the two things that Abraham wants most in life. These are the two things he's lacking. A land to call his own, where he should have his roots in, and children. By the way, when people translate, Mibeit Avicha, Me'aretz Mimoladetcha, some people translate that as your birthplace. Which is not true, because he wasn't asked to leave his birthplace. He wasn't born in Haran. So Molad probably means your larger circle of family. Leave your country, the land you're living in right now. Leave your larger family, Meravicha, and then leave your nuclear family, your father's house. That's how Kasuto and others translate Mimoladetcha. But so Abraham is being given these promises because these are things that Abraham is most lacking in his life, which is a little bit of an interesting approach. We're saying, why did God pick Abraham? God picked Abraham according to the Pshat approach, not because of Midrash that he believes in God, but because Abraham is lacking home and he's lacking children. So therefore, this is someone who God can teach these very important lessons to about what it means to have a home, what Eretz truly means, and what Zera, what children, should mean to you as well. And therefore, every promise that God gives Abraham is about land and children. And then Abraham encounters a situation where those, one or both of those promises are being jeopardized. His child is being jeopardized. His attachment to land is being jeopardized. If you look at his life within that context, he gets this general promise of land and children, and then every single event in his life challenges that and thereby gives Abraham an opportunity to hone in and realize what it means to have these promises from God. So for example, he gets to the land of Israel and there's a famine. He has to leave the land. So the Rav challenges the promise of Abraham getting the land. Also, it challenges the idea of him having a child because Sarah is being taken captive. And also being wealthy because now he's not in his own homeland. He's now a stranger in a foreign country. When he gets back to Israel, his adopted son leaves him. So Abraham, when he got that original blessing, may have thought, Zerah, who does God imply by Zerah? Maybe my nephew Lot. I consider him like a child. I've raised him. I'm taking care of him. We see in the psukim at the end of Parshat Noach, Abraham is taking Lot with him. But when Lot leaves him, oh, my child can't be Lot. That's not who God meant by the promise of Zerah. And when he has to marry Hagar, he has to give up on having a child with Sarah. Now he realizes that I thought perhaps the guy was going to be a child with Sarah, but now I realize that's not happening. Now he has to give that up and now marries Hagar and has a child with her. And later on, when he's told to have a Brit Milah, the question is going to be, can I have a child and endure this procedure at such an old age in my life? Will it affect my ability to have children later on? When he sends away his firstborn child, Yishmael, even after he gets the news about Sarah, one is a known, one is not yet a known. He has Yishmael. Yishmael's been in his family for 13 years. What do you mean send him away? Send him away. And then last, when God tells him to kill Yitzchak, how can he be asked to kill his chosen and selected Zerah? This makes so much sense when one looks at what comes in between each test. In between each test, God comes and reassures Abraham and clarifies to Abraham what the promises are. Who is the Zerah and when your children will get this land. So at first Abraham thinks that maybe his child is Lot and they're going to get the land right away. But through each ordeal, Abraham starts realizing it. And God tells him, not right now, not Lot, not Yishmael. It is Yitzchak, but not right now will you get the land of Israel. So Abraham is being taught to trust in God despite all the apparent contradictions to God's promises in his lifetime. These tests are tests because they challenge something that God himself promised Abraham. If you view it in this light, very often when we read, let's say, the 10th test, Akedat Yitzchak, that's the one where we challenge and say, how could God do this if God promised him Zerah? Ki b'Yitzchak yikarei lecha Zerah, and then next minute asked him to kill his Zerah. But if you look at it in terms of this concept, all his challenges were like that. You promised me land, now I can't live here. You promised me children, now my wife is being taken captive. They're all that contradiction between God's promise and reality of life. And then God comes and clarifies what the promise really is. And through these tests, Abraham learns valuable lessons about land and children. God promises Abraham exactly what he wanted and what he needed, a land to call his own and children to pass on this way of life to. But God wants Abraham to appreciate each of these blessings and recognize that they come with strings attached. They're not automatic blessings. Professor Kosuto gives his own creative list of what the 10 tests are, and this is what I have in front of you. If you notice, it's a little funny looking chart with little lines at the side. His chart, his list, is a chiasmus. A chiasmus is a literary structure. Some people call it a chiastic structure, but the real literary term is chiasmus. It's a literary structure from the Greek word meaning chias, meaning X, and it shows an interconnection of ideas. It's a way of writing things A, B, B, A. It shows a literary envelope where we begin and end the same way. And this connection of the tests demonstrates that they are separate events working in Avram's life, but they work together to help him achieve greatness. Kosuto's chiastic formula demonstrates the notion that each test builds off the previous test. The tests themselves have parallels and relate to one another. Avram was not just randomly given 10 tests, isolated tests, but rather each one leads into the next. The tests become more and more demanding and challenging or nuanced as Avram grows and develops in his Avodat Hashem. Now, that's what we're going to try to prove that today. Now, the first five teach one thing, but then the next five kind of like bump that up a little bit, make it a little bit more challenging and harder or nuanced lesson. I changed his list. So there's a star by one of his, Brit Bein HaTzarim. I changed that because I didn't like his. So his fifth one was the news of, I think, marrying Hagar and having Ishmael. And I changed that one to Bris Bein Absarim. And then the next one, which he really just included as the news about Yitzhak's birth, I included that for Mila because those will happen simultaneously. So for me, 5 and 6 are the Britot. I feel comfortable doing that because a lot of the Farshim include those two as the test. To go back to our earlier idea that Rashi includes Bris Bein Absarim. And I felt like it was kind of lacking in the Kosuto list. And then just having that birth of children didn't seem to be so challenging. So I did change his list, to be honest here. Okay. What I want to try doing is showing how this concept that Avraham is maturing and developing throughout his life. So the first five teach him one concept, and then the next five take that idea and teach it to him and make the test challenging, more challenging. So we're going to look at the parallels then. We're going to look at the A's, or 1 and 10. Lech Lecha and Akedat Yitzchak. These are the most obvious connections within the test. And these two are linked textually together. We already pointed out one of the connections. They both have the word Lech Lecha, great, in the command. They also have a similar order, ascending order of difficult things being mentioned. So Lech Lecha, it says Lech Lecha, Me'artecha, Mimoladecha, Mibeit Avicha, right? Leave your country, leave your extended family, leave your nuclear family, right? That ascending order of difficulty. Likewise, we had it by Akedat Yitzchak, Kachna et Bincha, Es Yechidcha, Asher Havta, Es Yitzchak, right? Take your son, your only son, the one you love, more specific, Yitzchak. So getting more specific in these listing of things mentioned in the Psukim. In both of them, there is an unknown destination. In the first test, God tells him, leave your country, El Aretz Asher Echad, that's the land which I will show you. The same exact language appears by Akedat Yitzchak as well. Go to El Echad Ha'arim Asher Amar Lecha. Go to one of the mountains which I'm going to tell you is the right mountain. But right now when you're leaving, you don't know where you're going. So the unknown destination appears by both of them. And obviously, in both of them, he's being asked to break ties with family. So where do we get to the difference in development? In Lech Lecha, Avram is promised great things. He's promised brachot. If you go to Eretz Yisrael, I'm going to make your name great. Nations of the world will bless you, and you will be blessed through them. In Akedat Yitzchak, there are no promises. In fact, the task seems to contradict all the promises which he was given. So when Avraham fulfills Akedat Yitzchak, he could not have done so for any ulterior or gain motives. He's doing it simply to fulfill Ratzon Hashem, God's will. But the main difference is that Akedat Yitzchak is much more difficult because who he's being asked to leave. To leave a child as opposed to leave his father's, his family, his past. Lech Lecha, he severs his connection with the past, but Akedat Yitzchak, he's willing to sever his relationship with his future. And thereby the lesson of these tests, again, the more nuanced, the more basic one, and then the more intensified, nuanced one later on, is that your family is not your own. That's something that I took from Leon Katz. I think it's beautiful. To be a patriarch, as ironic as it is, it means dedicating your life beyond the love of your own. Avraham, to be a patriarch, can't simply be a son. It can't simply be a father. He has to be much more than that. He has to show that he's willing to sacrifice his family and that he can't have a normal father-son relationship within the father of a nation. His son is not his own, and Avram is not merely just the father of Yitzhak, he's the father of his entire nation ensuing out of him. Now we're going to look at tests. We're going to group the next two together. We're going to look at 2 and 3 within 8 and 9. We have to obviously switch around the order a little bit. So that's why we put them together. In all four of these tests, there is a problem with a family member. Someone is in danger. Sarah is in danger. And or a family member separates. And Avram has a problem with a potential heir. And the problem is resolved by that heir leaving. So, interesting, what does Professor Casuto include as a test, which none of the Mepharshim that we saw included as a test? Everyone see that one? So marrying Hagar, Sarah being taken captive in Mitzrayim is 2, everyone included that. Sarah being taken captive in Gerar, number 8, we saw most people included that, not Rashi. Sending away Hagar Yishmael, everyone included that. The Rambam remember divided that in 2. But look at number 3, separating from Lot. Casuto is the only one who considers that a test. We didn't see that in the earlier lists of the 10 tests. And I really do agree with him on this one. Again, in the context of, Lot was Abraham's adopted child. He put all his hopes into Lot. And many Mepharshim see Lot as not just his physical heir, but his spiritual heir. Mepharshim comment about, HaNefesh Asher Asu B'charan, we're familiar with the concept that Abraham and Sarah converted people together. That's why it's plural, Asu. The souls that you made, in the lives that you made in Haran. How do you make lives? Midrash says, they converted people. The Radak on that pasuk says, Rav David Kimchi, it's not Avraham and Sarah. There wasn't like, you know, co-ed Kiruv movement back then. It was Avraham and Lot. Avraham and Lot were going out there and being Makariv and teaching people about monotheism. So when Lot now returns from Egypt and he's a changed, different person and he wants a different lifestyle than what Avraham can afford him, that was earth-shattering to Avraham. What do you mean my nephew, my son, doesn't want to continue spreading monotheism? And Avram says to Lot, if you go right, I go left, if you go left, I go right. And we often translate that means, you know, he gave him the option of going to Sodom. Well, that's not true. In the ancient world, you faced the Mizrah, you faced east. And north and south, sorry, right and left are north and south. Targum Unkla says this, and many of Farshim say this as well. So when Avram said to Lot, if you go right, or if I go right, you go left, what Avram is really offering Lot is, stay along the middle of the country, the path where we've been teaching and spreading monotheism. We've been going to Shechem and Bethel. We've always been staying along the middle of the country, away from perhaps the biggest cities on either coast, on the sides. But what does Lot do? Lot rejects that option, and he opts to move to Sodom. Sodom is that mini Mitzrayim. It's luxurious. The Pesukim say it's like Mitzrayim. It's an easy lifestyle. You don't have to keep uprooting yourself and traveling around spreading monotheism. You can just sit back by the pool and have an easy lifestyle. And that's what Lot chooses. That was hard for Abraham. That was his child rejecting his lifestyle and his mission. So while that was difficult for Abraham, if you turn to number 9, that's much more challenging. Losing your adopted son is hard, but losing your biological child, Yishmael, that's even harder. That's a stronger challenge for Abraham and his way of life. And also, we see the Pesukim as well there. Abraham doesn't want to kick out Yishmael. Sarah tells him to. God tells him to listen to Sarah. Abraham does it, but he's upset about it. He doesn't find it easy. He's not okay. He hasn't come to terms with it. He wants to keep Yishmael and his family as well. How do we get to the difference between 2 and 8 is challenging. This is what Susan asked before about how could Abraham, first of all, do this in general? Abraham was going to fight a war of 4 kings and 5 kings. He can't stand up for his one wife in a foreign country. So in order to explain the progression here, we have to, I think, turn to the approaches of Rav Hirsch, Chizkuni, and the Ran, and how they explain Abraham's story. Not like the Ramban. The Ramban here actually views the story that Abraham committed a sin. Ramban here says, Chet Chata Abraham Avinu. Abraham committed a great sin, actually, Chet Gadol. Which is interesting, because the Ramban doesn't give us his list of 10, but he should be still limited to the list in the Mishnah, where the Mishnah tells us Avraham passed all the tests. Ramban does not say that. Ramban thinks Avraham failed the test. But other Mepharshim who perhaps see Avraham as passing this test, how do they do so? So these approaches, what they argue and say, is that Avraham's best way of saving his wife, he wasn't looking out for his own skin. He wasn't just trying to save his wife and put his wife as a michshol avon, as a stumbling block for sin and have her commit adultery. But rather, Avraham realizes the only way he's able to protect his wife is if he remains alive and as a brother can hopefully stall or negotiate, you know, a marriage proposal on her behalf. So the reason why I said to you earlier is, Nachum Sarna perhaps quotes this idea that based on a scholar named Ephraim Spizer, who says that if you look at the Nuzi tablets, there's this relation called a wife-sister relationship, where someone can marry a woman and be a wife, but then they can also become a sister, a daughter's a sister. And they argued that the sister-wife relationship was even stronger than a regular wife. It entailed like certain rights that you couldn't marry any other women, maybe, and that she was the dominated wife, and she had the most respect and the most authority. So what they argue and say is that Abraham brought this Hurrian culture to Mitzrayim and said, no, I'm sticking up for my wife. Not only is she my wife, but she's also my sister. The problem with this cute approach is that it's not true. If you look at the text, it doesn't mean that. Wife, sister doesn't mean that you can be, the Hurrians didn't marry their sisters, their wives, and say that they're also their sisters. It's just not a true thing. But we do see that in the Hurrian text, that a brother and sister relationship is a strong relationship. The brother, very often in times where the father was unable, would arrange marriages for his sister. And he would get the bride price for the sister. So he could negotiate a good marriage or better marriage for her. And he could stall for her as well. So what the Mefarshim along this line say is that Abraham, by lying about their relationship, he was trying to stall, and hopefully, as long as he's alive, he could help Sarah. If he said that if he would openly say that they're married, they would kill him and rape Sarah. No matter what, she's in danger. Her danger is perhaps lessened if Abraham is at least alive and at least could help in the situation as long as possible. Again, I don't know if it's a great answer, but unless you turn to Abraham just sinning, it's hard to defend Abraham totally in the situation. So Abraham is trying to stall and protect Sarah. But how do we get the idea, though, that what Abraham did in the first time in Mitzrayim was great, but what he does in Abimelech is even greater? So here we have a little challenging part. On one hand, you could argue that Mitzrayim, they were known to be immoral. And we know that throughout Tanakh, how we view Mitzrayim, they were immoral people. Maaseh Mitzrayim, for example. Well, Abimelech, we know it by his response to Abraham. When Abimelech finds out that he was lied to, he says to Abraham, how could you bring me this chata'a gedolah, this great sin upon me? Using the language of great sin, referring to adultery, was not normal in the ancient Near East. It was considered a crime against the husband. The husband could even forgive you if you committed adultery. Abimelech is saying, no, in our country, we view it as a great sin. Parah doesn't say this. Parah was like, why'd you lie to me? But he doesn't say like, oh, if you would have told me the truth, I wouldn't have done it, because it's a great sin. Parah probably would have kept doing it, because in Mitzrayim, they were immoral, and they were known for these illicit relationships. So perhaps we can argue and say that Abraham was willing to, you know, put himself on the line in a very dangerous situation in Mitzrayim, but perhaps in the less dangerous situation, would Abraham go to such extremes? And the idea is that he still wants to protect Sarah, even when the danger is less severe. I think that's okay, trying to give a solution, but I think an even better way to solve the problem is what happens in between these two stories. Well, after Sarah was taken by Mitzrayim, and before Sarah was taken by Abimelech, God comes and tells Abraham that he's going to have a child with Sarah. So when Abraham goes down to Mitzrayim, he was never told that explicitly his child, his daughter, will come from Sarah. So when Sarah was taken captive, it's a big deal, he's upset about it, he loves his wife, but it's not as much of a threat to the idea of the child he's going to have from Sarah. But when Sarah is taken with Abimelech, it's much more of an affront to the promise he received from God. God told him, Sarah will be the mother of your child, and now she's taken captive? How can that be, God? You lied to me, right? Everything you promised me is false. And therefore, I think the lessons from these stories, putting them together, is that, again, losing of an heir, Yishmael and Lot, and then Sarah being jeopardized, is that the proper heir needs the proper parents and upbringing. Lot and Yishmael are lacking the proper parents. Yishmael is lacking the right mother. Lot's lacking both. And therefore, the proper upbringing. Which brings us to the next lesson. Abraham learns to appreciate Sarah not merely as the mother of his child, or future, but as a co-educator of his child. She is needed alongside Abraham to create the perfect heir, and not merely as an incubator, but as a teacher and parent alongside Abraham. Now let's get to 4 and 7. The war of the four kings and saving Lot, and saving Lot again, with Sodom being destroyed. So this is another one that I'm including here from Leon Kat, from Kasuto. Lot is in danger in both these situations. And these tests also involve a growth in Abraham. The first situation, why does he enter the war? Actually, Rabbi Wilva spoke about this before, the Palit. He enters the war just to save Lot. And once Lot is safe, he immediately goes back home. For Sodom, though, he's not merely concerned about his nephew. And after he even gets his nephew, he knows he can save his nephew, he goes on a limb to save the entire city. He goes on a limb and tries to save many more lives. The threat in 4 is man-made. It's a war between the 4 kings against the 5 kings. But in 7, the danger is God-made. And what Abraham learns in number 7 is that he has to accept God's justice even when it doesn't seem moral. And that's a more nuanced lesson. So stand up against God, battle, and really he takes on God when he fights, you know, to save Sodom. But he realizes that he has to acquiesce and say, I don't know better. Or he challenges God, right? Does the master of the universe not, how is that, lo yaseh mishpat, you're not going to do justice? But Abraham has to recognize and realize that God's justice is different than human justice, and you can't always understand and fathom it. So the lesson here is to stand up against evil, man-made or God-made. You may not win, but it's important to try anyway. And don't just care about your own, but you have to care about others. And this concept of responsibility towards others must be the objective of a patriarch. You can't just care about your own child. You have to see yourself as responsible for others, regardless if they are your flesh or not. And now we get to the middle ones, 5 and 6. So again, I changed these a little bit. For us now, they are the Brit Bein Avtarim and Brit Milah. Again, Kasuta view them as the birth of Yishmael and the birth of Yitzchak. And so we're included the version found from Rashi and Pirkei Eliezer who count Brit Bein Avtarim as a test. While the Rambam only counts Mary Hagar and the birth of Yishmael as a test for Avram, so we changed a little bit. These two tests are linked in that they're the only tests that involve a Brit, an actual covenant. The first one's a covenant about land, Brit Bein Avtarim, right? Your children will get this land. And the second covenant is more exclusively about children. Although these covenants are stronger than the original promises of land and children, each one of these covenants has a share of complications and tests involved within it. Abram asks in the first one, how will he know his children will inherit the land? And the answer he gets is that it will take at least 400 years for them to get the land. And in that process, they have to suffer and be tortured. That is clearly not the beautiful promise and covenant Abraham would have envisioned God's response. It takes so long, and they're going to have to be tortured and abused in order to get the land. For Brit Milah, Abraham is told he's going to finally have a child, the right heir, with Sarah. And then he's commanded to cut his reproductive organ. He's then told that all his male children will likely have to go through the same procedure forever. Obviously, Brit Milah is so ingrained in us as, you know, Orthodox Jews. But I remember the night before one of my son's brits, I said to my husband, do we really have to do this? And he's like, yep, I'm pretty sure it's one of the basics. We make our little 8-day-old children go through a procedure, have a little minor surgery. It's hard. This is something that was difficult for Abram to have to hear that his nation will have to go through forever. And Errol's mothers here know what I'm referring to. We all know we want to do it, but like, that feeling as being a mother, it's like, really? Do I really have to go through this? And the lessons of these two are that it's not enough for just you to work hard for these promises. Both these covenants involve something from his children. Your children will have to suffer to get Eretz Yisrael, and your children will have to keep suffering to maintain a relationship with God. Right? Brit Bein Avtarim didn't just happen once. It was probably this paradigm for Jewish history that we undergo and we go through suffering to eventually be redeemed. All future male children have to go through a Brit Milah to be part of the covenantal community with Abraham, that Abraham created with God. So it's not just enough for you to undergo these passages, but your children and your grandchildren forever will have to undergo the suffering and to be part of the covenant. So we, like Abraham, also have our own struggles to go through in order to get the land and to be considered God's chosen children. Now going back to our original question, our last question. Our third question. Why 10? The number 10 was not found in Tanakh, and the Mefarshim don't all agree to what the 10 are. And if I add up all the Mefarshim, I probably get to the list of like 15 tests for Abraham. So why is the Mishnah limited to this idea of 10? This idea I got from Rabbi Alex Israel, who wrote this idea on the VBM. That he says that numbers have significance in Tanakh. For example, 3 implies deliberation. Yonah's in the whale for 3 days where he's thinking about whether or not he should say he's sorry to God, right? Abraham travels 3 days before doing Akedat Yitzchak, so we have time to think and contemplate what he's about to do. We have 3 days to prepare for Matan Torah, exactly. What does 10 symbolize in Tanakh? 10 generations? Oh yes, 3 days Joseph in jail, perfect. What does 10 symbolize in Tanakh? So 10 Makot brought about our redemption. 10 generations from Adam to Noah, 10 generations from Noah to Abraham are epics in the human race. 10 Zibrot are our underlying foundation of Jewish society. In each of these 10, they're significant as a total, as a whole. But individually, they're not that significant. Which of these 10 Zibrot is the most important? Which of the 10 Zibrot, which of the 10 Makot is the most significant? It's not just one. All the 10s represent a whole greater than the sum of its parts. So too Abraham's life. He became Abraham Avinu not from one incident, not just from Akedah Yitzhak or from Lech Lecha, but rather each experience contributed to his development. The 10 tests provide an overview of his spiritual development. All 10, that sum, represent who he is, not just that one piece. That's perhaps why they suggest the 10. Now going back to our last of our original questions, why does God test Abraham? So there's a debate about what a nisayon is. The Ramban takes the approach, this is the last few sources, 9 and 10. The Ramban takes the approach that the test is for the person being tested. It's an opportunity for them to actualize their potential. The test is not for God, or not like in my example, and it's not for the teacher, but rather it's for the minusa, the one who's being tested. For Avram to see what he's made out of. For Avram to be proud of himself and say, look what I can accomplish. God gives him the ability to take his potential and actualize it. The Rambam sees the test, on the other hand, as not really for Avraham and not for God, but for us. It's an opportunity for others to see how far one must go in their devotion to God, to teach us what we should be like, what we should role model ourselves after. It's for the masses. And most of the farshim, I think, on Avraham do pick the statement in the Morna Vuchim version about we have Avraham's test that we learn how far we need to go in our dedication for God, Avraham being our paradigm. So God tested him so we can have a kind of like a case study who we can be like. But I believe both aspects are relevant by the 10 tests of Abraham. They allowed him to develop into himself, as we saw, and to demonstrate that as the first Av, he has to be willing to sacrifice everything for God, all these little challenges along the way, but eventually till at the end, his own son. But we also realize how far we have to go in our own Avodat Hashem. And the 10 tests are an expression both of God's love for Abraham, but of Avraham's love for God. And I think viewing Avraham's life within this concept, I think it gives us a lot of encouragement for our own lives when we meet challenges, that we obviously can pass them, and that God is not doing them only to, not hopefully not to torture us, but hopefully us to clarify the blessings in our own lives and to appreciate what we have and to help us grow as believers in God and get stronger and stronger as we develop in that way. I want to wish you all a very nice day and enjoy the rest of the last day of Hanukkah.